For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so we're going to study Jacob tonight. And because of the length of this thing, it's one coherent story covering six chapters. And what I've done is basically broken it down into a four-act play. And so we're going to begin with the first act, which is Jacob flees. Now, if you remember from our discussion last week, Jacob had some problems. Namely, that he is, just like his name says, he's a bit of a shyster. He's a manipulator. And he manipulated his older brother out of his birthright and out of his father's deathbed blessing. And so for that reason, Jacob flees, because Esau is not okay with the way things really went down. So the last part of the story of the Isaac story, which is Jacob's dad, and the beginning of the focus then on Jacob comes in chapter 28, verse 1, where it says that Isaac blessed Jacob, and he said to him, "You shall not take a Canaanite wife for yourself. Go to Padan Aram and to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father. Seek a wife from the daughters of Laban." That's where his wife came from, Rebekah, Jacob's mother. And he's basically saying, you need to go. The conditions for you right here are not so good now anyway. And so go find a wife. Get out of our hair. Here's the important thing we need to realize. Jacob is not a better man than Esau. Jacob receives the blessing of God that was passed down from Abraham to Isaac and now to Jacob. And this is something to be treasured and prized, not only the blessing of God on these men and their families in their own lifetime, but it holds also forth the promise of God's working through that promise and through that family that will become a nation and will be a blessing to all the nations of the earth. This is an amazing thing to be chosen to be a part of God's eternal plan for his creation. And Jacob wanted that way more than Esau did. But the point that we need to make, and we're really going to see how this comes out tonight and kind of comes to where Jacob has to come to terms with some things, is that Jacob is not a better man than Esau. He just simply wanted the better thing. And perhaps for all the wrong reasons as well. But nonetheless, he did. And so he has the blessing of God and is being sent away. And so he leaves. And then chapter 28, verse 11, it says that Jacob came to a certain place near Haran and spent the night there because the sun had set. He took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head and lay down in that place. And he had a dream. And the dream is Jacob's ladder. Some of us know this story. Here it is. He had a dream. Behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. The Lord stood above and said, "I am the Lord, the God of Abraham and Isaac. I will give you and your descendants this land. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, spreading out west and east and north and south. And you and your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed." Wow. So you're going to have more descendants than you could possibly count. They're going to be scattered all over the place, and that through them, God is going to bless the earth. "Now behold, I am with you wherever you go, and will return you to this land as I have promised you." So there it is. He's leaving, and the first interaction that Jacob has as he's leaving is with God himself. God is pursuing Jacob. Jacob's leaving under very bad conditions with his family. But God has not forgotten him, and God continues in pursuit. And so he pronounces to him a word of blessing. This is pretty important that his family is going to be this agency of universal blessing. And then there is this very important word of personal assurance. "I am with you." You don't really know where you're going. You've never been there before. You don't know what awaits you. You don't know about the dangers along the way. You have no knowledge of anything other than that your dad said you should go to this place and get a wife. And I'm telling you, God says, wherever you go, I'm with you. So whatever happens, God is saying, I'm in the mix. And he says, in addition, this land has been promised to you, and so you will return to it. So now Jacob has some very strong personal assurances. God's with him wherever he goes, and he's going to come back to this land. What's the only thing that we can count on in this life at the end of the day? That's the question that we really need to think about here tonight, each one of us. We may not be going to another land to find a foreign wife, or maybe we are. But wherever we're going and whatever we're doing, you can put your hope in your circumstances, your future plans, whatever those things may be, your bank account, your retirement account, whatever you might want to put your hope in and your trust in, your security in, your identity in. None of these things are assurances. The only thing that we can have real confidence in is the promises of God. And this is the important thing. This is the thing. What is the real strand that holds the beads together that is your life? Is it the promises of God? Because in that way, your life makes sense. There's a coherence. There's a confidence. There is a willingness to dare and to reach out and to risk, because we know that God is faithful to his promises to us. Without those assurances, all we are is a bag of beads without any connection to one another. We've got a real mess on our hands. A lot of us have lived life just that way. We're just kind of moving from one thing to the other, always in search, feeling that sense of being let down because why? Because what's the point of it all? What assurances do I have? Jacob has the assurance of God's word itself, and so do we as Christians. But here's the weird thing. It says in verse 20 that Jacob made a vow. And so you would think, okay, thank you so much, God, and you can count on me, and boy, those promises, awesome. He says, listen to the language very carefully in response to this great thing that God says to him. If God will be with me and will keep me on this journey and will give me food to eat and garments to wear and I return to my father safely, then the Lord will be my God. What a strange and ironic response to a God who has just said that through you, I'm going to bless the entire world and I am going to be with you wherever you go, and you will come back. And Jacob is like, well, if you do all of these things that I have on my list, then you, Lord God of heaven, creator of all things, the omnipotent, omniscient, transcendent God, then you can be my God too. That's just such a weird, weird prayer. So the obvious question is, how much Jacob is in you? Right? What conditions are you putting on following God? Do you, like Jacob, say, well, look, if you really take care of me on this journey, if you give me all that I need, food and eating, garments, you know, by garments, I don't just mean like fresh tunic now and then, but you know, some really good stuff and a great place to live. And so we just sort of have it all laid out. Here are my conditions, God, for I'll follow you if. And Jacob is going to find out that's not okay. That's not a game plan that's going to work. God is gracious and merciful, and he has given to him blessing and promised beyond anything Jacob could imagine. Jacob's response is just to ask this question, really, well, okay, what's in it for me now? If it seems like things are rolling my way, God, then yes, count me in and I will let you be my God. Wow. What's the word I'm looking for to describe this? Is it arrogance? Is it foolishness? Well, my suggestion would be to pick up a mirror and look at it and say, looks like me. Because isn't it true, all of us, you and me, no one's exempt from this. We're always in the back of our minds, perhaps, saying, yes, God, but. Sure thing, God, if. And it's this kind of thing. If things go my way, if people cooperate with my agenda, when I am viewed with all the respect that I richly deserve, you know, then I will be your servant. Then I will move toward difficult people. Then I will be the kind of person that others can rely on and so forth. And it's that if-then thing going on that is really a part of immature spirituality and which we wrestle with. And so God is intensely interested in dealing with this problem in Jacob's life. Now, Jacob's standing with God is secure. How do we know this? Because God has sworn an oath to himself that these promises of God to bless him and to bless the world through him are sworn on the name of God himself. And these things are going to happen. Jacob, rather, is God's man. But Jacob is not ready to be God's man. You know, he's accepted by God, but he's not useful to God in his present condition. And so what we are seeing in this narrative is the way that God works among his people, among his children, to take this kind of commitment, the maybe I'll let you, God, be God commitment, into something that's robust and powerful and actually very transforming indeed. Let's read on. Second act of our play, Jacob gets Jacobed. Remember last week that Jacob means, you know, conniving liar. Lesson number one. Yeah, it's a little bit of getting a little bit of you back in your face. So what happens is that Jacob goes to Paddan Aram and he finds this woman named Rachel and he is immediately taken by her. And it just so happens that she is the daughter of Laban, the very family that Isaac said, go find a wife among this guy's family. And Jacob was so taken by her that he says to Laban, this is chapter 29, verse 18, I will serve you for 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her. Oh, wow. Who says that, you know, romantic love isn't a part of the Bible story? This guy is so smitten, so in love, that he is prepared to basically be an indentured slave to Rachel's father just for the opportunity 7 years down the line to marry her. Wow. Dudes, be honest. I don't know. It's hard to imagine being in that situation. Oh, I'm sure I would. Wow. Wow. Well, let's read on. Then Jacob said to Laban, the 7 years are up. My time is completed. Now in the evening, it says, verse 22, Laban took his daughter Leah, the older one, and he brought her to Jacob. on this wedding night, and they slept together. Now in the morning, Jacob woke up and beheld Leah with him. Bah! What happened? Oh, that would just be an incredible moment. You know, because in the ancient world, I'm sure this is an evening wedding. There's no lights and stuff like that. And she's covered from head to toe. What a shock. So he went to Laban saying, "What have you done? Why have you Jacobed me?" I love Laban's response is classic. He says, "It is not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the firstborn. Jacob, you should have totally read the fine print 7 years ago when we had this conversation." So Laban is just completely out Jacobing Jacob. He said, "However, because I am such a nice guy, I will give you Rachel in marriage after another 7 years." Yikes. Well, Laban's good for his word, and indeed, now 14 years into seeking this woman's hand, finally they are married for another 6 years. They prosper in the household of Laban, but jealousies are beginning to emerge. And the broader servant household of Jacob's and Laban's, they're not getting along. And God has been so good to them that there are too many sheep and goats and animals and stuff like that. They're going to have to split them up and they're going to have to go their own way. So God tells Jacob, Act 3. "It's time, Jacob, now that you've been gone for 20 years from all of the drama that went down back at home, time for you to begin facing your fears." And so it says in verse 3 of chapter 31, "The Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers, to your relatives, and for the second time," he wants to make it clear, "I will be with you," which is code for fear not, right? Because I'm with you. Well, let's read on. Verse 3 says, "Jacob sent messengers." He's left, and his family left, and his wives with him, and their kids, and everything else, all their cattle. And Jacob is about to enter back into the land of Canaan, where his family is, and where his older brother Esau awaits. Yeah, the one that he stole the blessing from, that one. And so Jacob, knowing that Esau is there, says in verse 5, "I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and servants, and I have sent them to seek favor in your eyes, Esau." I'm going to try to grease the skids a bit with my reentry. And the messengers returned from Jacob, from the meeting with Esau, back to Jacob, telling Jacob that Esau is coming to meet him with 400 men. Jacob, it says, was nervous. Okay, so let's again think about what's going on here. Jacob rips off Esau, steals the birthright. It's a binding birthright. It's the deathbed blessing of Isaac to the inheritor of the covenant with God and everything that goes with it. Esau, unhappy about this, wishes his brother were, well, dead. And Jacob, 20 years out now, has left, has prospered, and now God is saying it's time for you to go back. But what is he going back to? He's going back to an older brother who, the last time he saw him, wanted to fillet him. Now, with 400 men to say hi. Apparently, the gift of oxen, donkeys, flocks, and servants didn't really grease the skids in the way that Jacob was thinking maybe they would. He was thinking, well, you know, maybe they'll just say, oh, this is awesome. Let's go back home. But no, it's like an army out to meet him. So what does Jacob do? He prays. Finally, we're now in chapter 32. This thing started in 28. Finally, Jacob prays, says, oh, God of my father Abraham, of my father Isaac, oh, Lord, who said, remember whose idea this was, return to your country and your relatives, and I will prosper you. Just in case you forgot, let me remind you. But then he says in verse 10, I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and faithfulness which you have shown me. That's interesting. That's a bit of a change. Deliver me, he says, and I pray from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear that he will attack me and my family. For you said, again, let me twice in this prayer remind you, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be numbered. So Jacob prays. And let's think about what's going on in his head. He's thinking, wow, this is really that moment, isn't it? This moment that I have been trying not to think about for 20 years, where my past and my future come together in this moment. And what is going to happen? Wow, I don't know. But let's break it down. It's really clear that the walls are really beginning to close in around Jacob at this moment. And that conniver and deceiver who brought so much pain into other people's lives. Can you imagine, as it describes, when Isaac finally realizes that he has blessed Jacob instead of Esau. And Esau, it tells us at the end of that story, let out a cry and lament. Wah! Jacob remembered that. And of course he fears that that hunter, tough guy, older brother of his has him right in his sights. Oh, yeah. And just, you know, you can run from your past, but you cannot hide. And God, because he's merciful, is going to bring us right back into a face-off with our past. Not to rub our face in it, but rather so that we can overcome it, so that we can be changed by it. And so that's what's beginning to go on here. Then there is, it seems at least, some humility. For the first time in the Jacob story, he's not conniving and planning a scheme, but he is recognizing his basic unworthiness with God. You know, he might have remembered that vow that he gave on his way out of town those 20 years earlier, saying, well, you know, if you come through for me in the ways that I want you to come through for me, then you, God, Lord of heaven and earth and all things, can be my God. And now he's realizing how utterly unworthy he is. Because why? Because now the weight of what he has really been about is really coming to bear in on him, the weight of it. And that's an important piece of this. That's where things really begin to change in our lives, when we realize that it's time to develop some humility, to understand ourselves deeply so that we can entrust ourselves more fully to God. There is with this a plea for protection. Deliver me. And of course, he remembers, you said these things to be true. And in that way, Jacob's prayer is a kind of a transitional moment in his life. And in a lot of us, we need to think about this. that yes, we do sense that I have not been able to run and hide from these things in my life, and that I can begin to look back and see a whole pattern of failure that leads right to my doorstep. I realize those things are there. And with that, really a moment of clarity, as some have called that, where we realize that whatever I have in my life, it is purely the gift of a generous God, something I in no way deserve. And so now he's looking at God through a very different lens and on a different platform, now the platform of grace, appealing to him as one who is generous, who is loving and kind and so forth. And then just making that plea on the basis of that for his protection based on his promise. Now we come to our final scene where this whole thing begins to come together now, wrestling with God. In chapter 32, verse 24, says that Jacob was left alone. That's a haunting context. He's just gotten the news about his brother and the 400 coming his way. He's had this humble interaction with God, and now he is alone. And it says a man wrestled with him until daybreak, all night long. When he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh so that the thigh was dislocated while they continued to wrestle. What an odd event. This man with whom Jacob is wrestling all night, it says, and did not pin him, right? But nonetheless kept Jacob in that wrestling mode. Finally comes to a place where it's like, it's about time that this thing is over. And so, apparently in an effortless way, he just reaches over and dislocates Jacob's thigh. Takes that femur and pops it right out of the socket. He said, Jacob did, let me go, for dawn is, or not Jacob, but the wrestler says, let me go, dawn is breaking. But Jacob said, I will not let you go until you bless me. So he said, what is your name, liar, deceiver? Well, your name is no longer going to be liar, deceiver, Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. Israel means strives with God. Jacob is changed to Israel in this moment. Wow, what is going on here? What does it mean? It means just a couple of very important things. One, it means that Jacob is really, he's coming to an end of his ability to fight. Literally, God has taken this man to the mat, pinned him, dislocated his hip. And now the disputing with God, the arguments with God, the I'll go my own way with God is coming to an end. And he's yielding. He's humbled before God. Here's the question. Who has the real say-so in your life? Up to this point, for Jacob, the answer was easy. It's Jacob. It's his plan. And never before had he been pinned in this way. Sure, he had been run off by his brother. Sure, he had been out-Jacobed by Laban and spent 14 years in indentured servitude to him. Yeah, he had had some things, but he still walked away with his ego, his game plan intact. It's still my plan. And now something has changed. He's no longer that guy. And so the real question that God was imposing upon him, look, you cannot inherit the blessings that I've given to you on your steam and in your own way. You have got to yield to me. And so I ask you, my Jacob friends, who has the say-so in your life? Whose agenda do you serve? And how's it going with that? And God, because He loves you, will pursue you as He did with Jacob and wrestle you to the ground. Jacob is no longer giving these if-then prayers, if you do these things, then you can be my God. A God of the gaps is no God. The God of the gaps is an expression that comes from the great German leader of the underground movement during World War II in Nazi Germany. And he wrote a book called The Cost of Discipleship, which he earned by paying the cost of his own life to stand against the evils that were the Nazi movement. He makes this point. He says, look, for most people who are Christians, like Jacob, we trust and believe in God because we believe that He's going to give us blessing. And so as long as those blessings are flowing as we want them to flow, and, you know, thank you, God, that I got this thing in my life that I've been seeking, you know, a spouse, a career, a home, and all these things I've been praying for, now seems like there's not really much left to pray for anymore. I've got what I want. And so there is this just utter lack of real spiritual reality in so many of our friends who are living as Christians just like their non-Christian neighbors, because that all along, like Jacob, we've been interacting with God on the basis of His providing us the things that we've wanted. And as He has allowed us to receive these things, He has become an increasingly vague and distant abstraction in our lives. There's no way that we could pray the prayer that Jesus called on His disciples to pray. Give us this day our daily bread. Really? Why should I ask for something that I can just go right down to the grocery store and get for myself? You see what I'm saying? And so, this is the real challenge of Jacob, and it's the challenge of we who are like Jacob. We have that affluence. We have the ability to get done what we want done. We can have what we want by and large. And the cost that we pay for that is just increased, diminished reality of God in our lives. We wonder, what's God even really about? And God, in His love for us and mercy, continues to pursue us just like He did with Jacob. And He is going to force us to come to terms with our failed plan and our completely diminished view of Him. We may be at a place where we're beginning to realize, you know, what I really need is freedom. These things were once vices, now they're habits. We sense that we're a little bit burned out on the things that we thought would give us satisfaction. They're no longer doing that for us. And yet I feel bound by these very same things. I need freedom. You know what that means? What that's like? What it means to really be a slave to things that you know are suffocating you in terms of your inner life, in terms of your relationships with other people, in terms of that sense of closeness with God? What are those things for you? And we sense, I need freedom from that, but I don't know the pathway of freedom. And so what we are saying is that God, because He's God, because He loves you, is going to take you to the mat and cause you to say, uncle. Does that translate anymore? When I was a kid, that's what you did. When someone who's bigger than you wanted to show you where it's at, they would get you, they would twist your arm behind your back and a half Nelson pressing up to a full Nelson, and you're going, ah, ah, and they're saying, give up. And you're saying, no way, no way, give up. Give up now, now. Say uncle, now, oh, uncle. Finally, uncle. I had an older brother. And God is going to take you to a place in your life, and he's going to say, say, uncle. Say, I've come to the end of this way of living, this failed project, and I'm giving that up. And that's what God seeks. How do you know if you're wrestling with God as Jacob was? How would you know? You know, maybe your arm feels pretty good, you know. Things are going great. How do you know? You know when it becomes clear to you, for instance, like Jacob, that you're manipulating people to get your own way. That you're just really adept at forming friendships with people who are going to tow your boat, who see things your way and who are going to take your side and who are going to support your agenda and your thing. That would be one indication. When you look around, nobody ever disagrees with me. Everyone seems to be thinking that I've got it all together and I'm doing it all the right way. Who are you talking to? Nothing more than an extension of yourself. And so that's manipulation. Jacob manipulated people his whole life. And now is at a place where he's pinned. He cannot manipulate. There's nothing he can do except for cry uncle. Maybe you are one who's dealing with just chronic disappointment in your life. That nothing just ever seems to be good enough. Nothing ever really satisfies. And you just are going through the motions of life, feeling oddly like I ought to be content and satisfied, but inwardly, in a deep way, you know that you're not. And that just not being right within yourself, not feeling deeply connected to other people, not feeling any sense of real closeness with God. We wonder, you know, why should I give myself wholly to God? What's in it for me? It just seems like this is, you know, just so much work, duty, obligation. Really worn down and tired by that. What's God done for me lately anyway? And so when people come to this place, and many of us have been to this place, I've been to this place, and the rest of you are going to get to this place. We have to understand that disappointment that we feel is a warning sign. You know, physical pain is a good thing. No, I'm not a masochist. Where would you be without pain? Pain is your body's alarm system that says there's something wrong with you. You should stop doing what you do because it's not good for you. That's what pain does. Well, similarly, when we think about, when we look at our inner life and we find that we are just chronically dogged by a sense of disappointment, of anxiety, driven by fears, able to do fewer and fewer things because we're just more and more anxious about life. When we are feeling pretty consistently like others conspire against us, they never really understand us, we feel that sense of isolation and distance. What is that? That is the spiritual equivalent to pain. That tells us there's something really broken about you deep inside. Now, we live in a very therapeutic culture where if we feel that inward discontent, we feel that that's a problem that would require a numbing device, a pill or whatever. And I want to be clear that we can come to a place in our lives where physiologically our bodies have adjusted to just this very kind of thinking. And it requires often some medication to get us into a place where we can actually make choices to get out of the groove that we've dug ourselves in. But with that said, the reality is we feel these things, this depression, this anxiety, this anger, whatever it is within you, and it is a warning sign. Not that there's something wrong out there. Of course there's something wrong out there. But more importantly, that there's something wrong in here with me. That's the issue. How would you know you're wrestling with God? Because God in His graciousness has brought to your attention that you're discontent with your life as it is and that you are on the run. Just like Jacob. Let's just bring it home then. There's a result that occurs. Jacob goes away. Israel takes his place. Something permanent has changed in Jacob's life. It's pretty amazing. I really liken it to what the author of Hebrews, possibly Paul, says in Hebrews chapter 12, really about this very thing that we're talking about here. He says, "Those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines." Now, Jacob is experiencing discipline. That's what that wrestling match is all about. I am going to prevail over you. And I'm going to dislocate your hip just to underscore the fact that my power is greater than yours and you need to yield to it. The Lord loves Jacob. He did not do this to punish him or to shame him or anything like that. He loves him enough to discipline him. And then he goes on to say, all discipline for the moment seems to be sorrowful, not joyful, but afterwards it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. So strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble. Make straight paths for your feet so that the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. So there's a little echoes, I think, toward the end of that verse of the Jacob situation there. What is our author saying? He's saying that the discipline of God is intended to give us peace. Because the reality is that when our agenda is not God's agenda, when we are living life on our terms, when we have an if-then relationship with God, if you just do these things, then you can be my God, that puts us in absolute opposition to the purpose and the plan of the Lord God Almighty. And I can guarantee that if we want to continue living life in defiance of God, we will not be at peace. And we're going to feel that inner turmoil, and nothing's going to seem to satisfy it. And that sense of discontent that will just become increasingly pervasive over the course of our lives, poisoning everything that we're involved with. But when God begins to have His way, when we're on the mat and we can say, "Uncle, okay, I understand. The problem in my life is not the person I'm married to or the children that I have or the loneliness that I feel for not being married or the boss who sucks or the neighbors that are not any good or these terrible parents that I had or whatever it is," and maybe all that's true. None of that, however, has to do with whether or not we feel peace. When we begin to connect the dots in our life and say, the reality is that what I'm experiencing and this discontent that I have is God saying, "There, you've got to surrender. You've got to yield. You've got to say, Uncle, what more is it going to take?" What does that look like? What it looks like is to go before God, and much like what Jacob did, and to say, "God, you have made promises to me. You have promised that I am your son or your daughter. You have promised to me that there will come a moment in history when you call me home and I will be completely transformed, and all these things that I struggle with in the present are going away, and I will be conformed to the image of your Son. And you have promised that you will never leave us or forsake us, that you who began a good work will complete it in the day of Christ. These things are promises that you have made, and that is the ground on which I stand. And in the light of that promise and who you are who makes a promise like that, God, I want to just present myself to you and all of my fears, my disappointments, the Esaus that are reminding me of all the unfinished business of my life. And I just want to say, I just can't do it my way anymore. And I yield to you, God. You show me the better way. You've got my attention. I hear you. And I believe, God, that you will lead me, that you'll bring your people into my life to provide counsel, that as I engage with you in the Word of God and in the Scriptures, that you will speak to me, that I will, and that I will choose to obey these things that I learn. And as a result, what will happen is this peaceful fruit of righteousness. Righteousness is not piety or I'm better than somebody else or something like that. Righteousness is being right with God. The righteousness of God, as it's described in the Old Testament, is his goodness. It's tied to his love. And to have peace, what an awesome thing is that. And then, just lastly, a final point. There is the limp. And Jacob limped. For the rest of his life, the evidence was there of God's dealing with Jacob. Every day, he could get up and realize, I wrestled with God and prevailed. I'm Israel. Sorry. And there will be those painful reminders. And that also is a gift of God, because he does not want us to forget that we wrestled with him. And that's okay. He doesn't just sort of, all pain is now gone and so forth. It's no, you're changed by this. And for that reason, I'm going to keep that reminder of how far I have taken you and how good I have been to you. And I think about that quite a bit in my own life. I am a Jacob. I mean, there's no getting around it. The reason I give these examples of discontent and of depression and fear and all this kind of stuff is not because I read it in a book someplace. It's because I looked in the mirror and said, that's me. Okay? It's me, and it's you too. And we do need to reckon with our pasts, even if that past is just last week or last month, but it could be decades. For most of us at this stage, it is decades. And it's time to recognize how broken we are and how good God is. And the only way that we get to that place is just to have the humility that comes through breaking, through coming to that place where there's no longer excuses left. It's just, here's me, God, and I just need to present myself to you. And now lastly, I want to speak to our friends here tonight who are saying, huh? And because this is an in-house discussion, this is something that Christians understand, that when we come into a relationship with God, that he's not done with us. It's the beginning of real transformation. And it is transformation that continues on through the course of our lives and is completed when we meet God face to face. But there is a promise that I want to extend to you here tonight as well. It is the purpose that God called Jacob and Isaac and Abraham before him. And that is to be a blessing to the whole earth. How is that blessing manifested? In this, that God gave his son, Jesus Christ, to come into the world and to take upon himself the burden of Jacob, my burden and yours, the weight of our guilt, our failings, so that the judgment of God could be poured out upon Christ, who substitutes for us and therefore can extend to us total forgiveness. And so that we can interact with God, not on the basis of my failures as a separation between me and God, but as a son or daughter of God, based upon the work of Christ for me that reconciled me to him through forgiving my sins. And he's calling on you. Here's the point right here for you is, why not take him up on that offer, even here tonight, and to say, you know, I understand those things that were described about what it means to wrestle with God, because I wrestle with myself. I'm aware of these things. I don't have an answer for them, though. I've been looking for an answer to these things. And I'm telling you, this is the answer. Get reconciled to God on the basis of Christ.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.